Hi, I'm Lise Wheel, and this is Wheel of Justice, the Cal Harris Story, Episode 8. Last time on Wheel of Justice, the Cal Harris Story, you heard Cal's lawyer, Bruce Barquette, discuss the case against Cal. He talked about the inaccuracies that he says have been told or shown to jurors by the prosecution. He also talked about Stacey Stewart and Chris Thomason, the two men he thinks were involved in Michelle's disappearance. At this point, you may be as sure as Angela Prusinski, the juror from the first trial that I spoke with in Episode 4, that Cal murdered his wife. After all, there are a lot of things that, taken as a whole, could equate to Cal being a murderer. You have people who say Cal threatened Michelle and was angry and controlling. You have the prosecution telling you that Michelle and Cal were in the midst of a bitter divorce, a divorce that Cal did not want. And you have a small amount of blood found in the Harris estate. Conversely, you may be just as certain that he didn't do it. As Bruce Barquette points out, the small amount of blood found in the Harris estate does not equate to a crime scene, much less the place where Cal killed Michelle. And what about all of those resources dedicated to investigating Cal as the murderer? With all of that attention on him, it seems hard to believe he could have killed his wife and hid her body without someone being the wiser. Or maybe, after learning all about this story, you're still just as uncertain about what happened as you were when you started listening to the series. With no body and no weapon, you'd be forgiven for having trouble saying with certainty what happened to Michelle. I have to admit, I often find myself in this third camp, which typically means my mind is running with the possibilities. Well, all along in this series, you've been hearing my voice, but I have to tell you that I've had partners in this crime, Jennifer Williams, Willie Sanchez, and Rick Buser. Now, Jennifer, Willie, and I took a very interesting field trip up to Schoharie Courthouse and all around to really look at what was going on in the case and to really kind of get in-depth and behind the scenes. Jennifer, what were some of the things that we found that no one else had discovered?
One of the first things we got was when we went to get trial transcripts, because for the second and third trials, we couldn't get them online.
Right.
And we were just conversationally speaking with some of the people in the court, and someone close to the trial told us that the third trial was a 6-6 split.
And nobody knew that,
right,
at the point.
No one knew that. So we knew what the mistrial jury split was, which was great because it's easy to imagine that it would be close, but
right. Really
it wasn't close at all. So Bruce Barquette, obviously, Cal's lawyer, did really great arguing for him.
What about when we went upstairs to the courthouse and we said that to Mr. Spees, the courthouse clerk, that we knew it was 6-6? What was his response when we said that?
He immediately shut down. We weren't supposed to have this information, so he was very quickly like, no, that we don't know what it is. There's no way you could know what it is. He wouldn't confirm at all. He didn't go for it.
No, but he was pretty upset with
us,
I think.
He was upset.
He was not happy with us. And when we were up there at the courthouse, a couple floors up, what happened? Did we get some documents?
We did. We got very recently unsealed documents that Cal's defense wanted to bring into the trial that showed strong evidence that two other men from Texas were involved in Michelle's disappearance. And since it wasn't brought into the trial, the judge ruled that most of it was hearsay, I believe it was. So it's not part of the trial transcript. It only got unsealed after the trial ended. So we got that new information.
That was brand new.
Brand new information.
And once we had Cal's lawyer in here, we were able to confirm that with Cal's lawyer,
right,
because he said that as well.
Right.
Willie, what were your impressions of the courthouse?
Well, at first, I think they were a little apprehensive to help us out with anything, and that we brought some donuts and coffee, and that always helps someone get over the initial introductions and whatnot. They were really helpful with everything that we needed. They did the best they could. Their copying prices were a little...
Tell us about that.
I think it was 50 cents a page.
It was crazy. So we had to sort of improvise after that.
I think it was a $22 bill for a couple pages that we got.
But they were very nice. And their computer technology was not quite up to what, I guess, we were used to. But
no.
But they were
helpful.
Yeah, they were helpful, especially with that 6-6 slip. That was very helpful. Any other impressions, that Jennifer, that you had really on that field trip? What about going out to actually see Michelle's gravestone?
Well, just going back to while we were at the courthouse, remember we went up to see Mr. Spies, we overheard
Thanks for remembering me.
Two court officers talking about, will there be a next trial? How much would it cost? I can't remember. What was...
We were overhearing. I was just kind of looking at some notes, and you and I were talking, and there was these two guards right as we were to go through them in a few minutes. We were waiting for Willie to park the car. And Willie drove, by the way, 9 hours that day.
Total of 9 hours, yeah.
It was a long day.
It was a long day, but we had fun.
We were talking the whole way about what we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. And I'm just sitting there writing stuff down. I hear the guards talking, yeah, the big trial's over. And the other guard says, yeah, but you know what's going to happen. Another one's going to happen. Oh, yeah, I know. We'll get ready in the fall. And then the other one said, you could fly the whole county out to Hawaii for what it's costing for this trial. And I wrote that down really quickly because I said, that's the feeling, right? They're kind of a little bit, it's a small county. This is not like a big metropolitan area.
Right.
And they're spending a lot of money. How much money have they spent already on these trials?
Close to $150,000, I believe it is, just on the first three.
I think that's right. That's a lot of money for a small county like that. So, all right, so we leave the county courthouse and we go and we are searching for Michelle's gravestone.
Right. It took us a while.
A long time.
It wasn't mapped out very well in that graveyard, or in the cemetery. So it took us a while. I think we drove around 3 or 4 times before we saw it.
And it was right at the front.
Mm-hmm. It's right at the front.
We could have stopped at the front gate and just walked to it from there.
And it's really, really, it's so sad, you know, to imagine this father. Her gravestone's right next to her mother's, and he's never had confirmation that she's dead, but he's set up this gravestone in memory of her life, and I guess, you know, wanting some kind of closure. It's very sad to see it.
Can I ask a question about this?
Yes,
there's
Rick.
You know, it's kind of a morbid question, but what do you put at a gravesite when there's no body? I mean, did they bury anything there? Articles, you know, stuff from the kids, you know, that remember her or
no, by? No, there's nothing there, and it's kind of a strange inscription, which it would sort of led you to believe that maybe they thought she was still alive.
I think it said something like, everything's fine or everything's going to be okay or...
Well, forever in our hearts, it's all right.
It's all right.
It's like a song, it's all right. Isn't that strange, Rick?
Yeah, that is kind of ambiguous, but it's kind of consistent with the entire trial and the entire history of what has gone down and all the unknowns.
Well, one of the things we thought about when we read that was like, okay, what if that was a secret message to her? If she really did leave... Was that a secret message to her? It's all right that she came back to say, yeah, the kids are fine. Everybody's fine.
Right.
Right?
Like they're now, taking care of the kids.
That goes to what we really want to get into here in this podcast is other theories. And I want to start with that theory, this sort of she's still alive, gone girl. Right? And Jennifer thought, first of all, you thought that was what happened. Right, Jennifer?
Yes.
That's an idea that Michelle Harris is still alive. I think it's incredibly unlikely. Here was this woman that, you know, she obviously marital issues and she wanted to be younger than she was and all that kind of stuff. But she did love her kids. She would leave her kids. But why did you think or do you still think that maybe the gone girl theory is still workable?
Well, the deeper we got into this case, the more it became clear that her life at some point had taken a huge shift. She didn't want to be the millionaire's wife with 4 kids anymore, and it became very clear because she took a job that she didn't necessarily need. And not only that, she took one at a bar working at night where she's meeting a lot of, we now know, seedy individuals. You start hearing that she's having affairs with multiple men and she's possibly involved in drugs. It started to build in my mind that she no longer wanted the life she had, including her kids. Even if she loved them, she got married pretty young and they had 4 kids pretty quickly. I think she got married when she's just shy of 25 and then they had kids pretty quickly after that. So maybe she wanted her youth back and she just wanted to disappear and not have any responsibility. And I had just seen Gone Girl. So it was just in my head that this could be what happened. You know, she staged some blood in their house, and then she's gone. She had some jewelry that everyone knew she was trying to pawn that has never been found, worth, I think, estimated around $15,000.
That would give her a start.
A start. She had an engagement ring and a Rolex also with her. So she could have started, changed her appearance. Maybe went to Canada.
And maybe a way to get back at Cal. That's a great way to get back at Cal. She knows he's going to be framed or, you know, targeted for the murder. I don't know. Brian Early seems more plausible to me. Let's talk about Brian Early. He's 22 when he meets Michelle, 23. He lives in Philadelphia. He's got a girlfriend there. And he leaves everything behind for Michelle. They start buying a house together, and Michelle pretty much dumps him. Doesn't he have primary motivation for murder?
Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't play a bigger role as a suspect in this at all. I mean, he came up as a witness, more or less, but that was it. That's what I felt like at the end. I would have definitely looked at him as a prime suspect of someone. How come you haven't left him yet? Mm-hmm. Aren't we going to be together forever? I gave you money for a house. Like
$5,000 he dumped in the house, right?
Yeah. We did find Brian, or we thought we found Brian.
We thought we did.
Well, let's not say we, Jen. So, Jen, tell us a little bit about
what happened.
So, I started looking for him on Facebook to try to reach out to see if he would want to talk about this, because he undoubtedly loved Michelle a lot, and he saw a future with her. And I think Bruce Barquette's theory that on 9/11 you would talk to someone you love about the future, maybe she told him he wasn't part of that. And let's say he follows her home and they get in a fight on the driveway and he kills her there, takes her body and leaves the van. I think he's the last person that we know to see her. And all they do is they smell a gun in his apartment. They don't look at him for defense wounds. They don't do forensic analysis of his apartment or his cabin where he hunts. I think he could have hit her very easily. The focus was all on Cal. And he had all these years to get rid of her body. So I wanted to talk to him. We all wanted to talk to him to see what he had to say about it. We found him on Facebook, and I matched his picture with some news stories about this trial and even the tattoo that he has on his arm. We called him, and first time the wife answered, I told her why I was calling, and she didn't say that I had the wrong number. She said, he's at work. You can try later tonight or in the morning.
Which would make you think you've got the right number.
Right. So I called back in the morning, and that's when he told me that we had the wrong guy.
And then I called him as well.
About this trial.
You made two phone calls, one in which the wife said he'll be back later, the second which he denied you've got the wrong Brian Earley. The third I called, and he said, I don't know who you're talking about. You've got the wrong Brian Earley. So then what did you do?
I found his wife on Facebook. I sort of started stalking them on social
media. The wife who was his girlfriend before he met Michelle.
The wife he left for Michelle, yes. Was his girlfriend at the time. I went through her Facebook, and she had an old photo, I think for an anniversary, just like a throwback photo of her and him, and it's the same guy. Same tattoo.
Absolutely.
Same facial expression, same facial hair.
So we had the right guy.
We had the right guy, which is fine. It just seems more normal or natural to say, I don't want to talk about this, like Jerome said to us.
Jerome, remember the hairdresser who testified at trial? Jerome said to me, when I asked him to talk, and he said, no. I said, why? He said, he's a rich man, and he hasn't been convicted yet. Whoa.
He's scared of something. But that's a normal denial of talking to us, not to just outright lie. Like, for him to say, I don't know about this Cal Harris trial. And then when we called again, he was like, I've looked it up now, and I really don't know who this guy is. You know, he embellished the story even more. It's weird to me.
So does Brian Earley remain a prime suspect for you?
Not prime, but I think he should have been looked at in a deeper way. He's had enough time to dispose of her, I think.
In a previous podcast, when we interviewed Bruce, he talked about two gentlemen. I mean, wouldn't he have looked at Brian? And I'm sure he has. And if he thought Brian was a suspect, that he would have put that out there.
Yes.
And he didn't.
Yes. Well, let's go to Stacey Stewart and Chris Thomason. But let me just answer that question about why he may not put it out there. If you're a defense lawyer and what you want to create is reasonable doubt, you don't necessarily want to pick a bunch of people with different theories to create that reasonable doubt. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
You want to focus, laser focus on Stacey Stewart and Chris Thomason, for example, and not just then say, oh, and there's Brian Earley up there. Because if I'm a juror and I'm listening, I'm hearing, that's a defense lawyer. He's desperate. But if he's really focusing on just one or two people with one theory of the case, then I'm more interested as a juror.
So the same reason why a prosecutor is focusing on somebody.
Hey, Lisa, is there any issue with possible defamation if you just throw somebody's name out as a defense lawyer that, you know, may never have been charged with
anything? No, because they were part of it. They were at least mentioned at the trial, though most of the testimony about them did not come in. And, you know, no, I don't think so. I mean, suppose they could. But, you know, that's the other thing, is truth is always a defense to defamation cases. So I don't see Stacey Stewart and Chris Thomason coming out after Mr. Barquette anytime soon.
Right. I just find it so fascinating that one actually works in the prison system.
And one is in the prison.
Right. Exactly.
So it's
full circle.
Full circle. Let's set this up a little bit with Stacey Stewart and Chris Thomason. What did we find out about them? And remember, those a lot of that's what we found out came in those unsealed documents. They literally, guys, were unsealed in front of our eyes as we're standing there in the courthouse or the court clerk's office.
So we learned that in the summer of 2001, they both moved from Texas to New York, and they worked as steel workers for a company called Volcraft. According to several people, they frequented Lefties a lot, which mm-hmm. is where Michelle was working. A lot of people say that Stacey Stewart had an intimate relationship with Michelle. Some people say she was also sleeping with Chris Thomason, but I think the general consensus is definitely she was with Stacey Stewart. And on the night of September 11th, some people saw her with Stacey Stewart at a dance club around 11 p.m., which would mean she left Brian Early's mm-hmm. and went out with Stacey Stewart. Chris Thomason said he saw them together at the club, so that would mean he's the last one with Michelle that we know of. They were interviewed several times over the years, and their stories changed so much. They lied about things like...
Yeah, tell us about the lies.
Stewart claims that he went home after work on the night of 9/11 and didn't go out.
That's a lie?
Even though several people said they saw him out with Michelle at the club. He also says that he never went out with Michelle and many times said he knew of her, didn't even know her name. One of Michelle's sisters-in-law, I believe, said in an interview that Michelle had told her they had been intimate. A lot of people knew that they were having a sexual relationship, and he's denying it. Why would you do that unless you've got some guilt, you know?
What was the statement that we heard about? One of them said about concrete and the garage.
Well, there's the burning bloody clothing. Mm. Stacey Stewart at one time said Chris Thomason and a woman showed up all bloody, and they had to burn the bloody clothing at his house. Bruce Parquette's theory is, I think, that there were two sets of bloody clothing, and then there wasn't a woman. It was Stacey Stewart and Chris Thomason's. And I think at one point, Chris had said that it's because he had been hunting. But as far as I can tell, September would not be hunting season. So unless he's hunting illegally for deer, he shouldn't have been bloody from that. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the fact that Stacey Stewart put in new concrete in his barn right around the time that Michelle disappears.
Now, Bruce told us when we interviewed him that they actually went out to that garage and dug it up.
Right.
But this was so many years later, and it didn't find anything. But this is so many years later that you probably, even if Michelle was there, you wouldn't, you know, necessarily find anything.
Well, you could find bones or something, but who knows?
Let's get back to the clothing for a minute, because this burning the bloody clothing, it sounds like a ritual. I mean, why would you do it?
I think it's like burning evidence, you know? It's
I get that part, but other than making them look guilty, what would be their rationale for doing it if they had to explain it to someone?
Good question. Well, they said they were hunting, but why would you? All right, so you're out hunting. Your clothes get bloody.
You throw it out.
You throw it out, or maybe you try to put some ammonia on it and wash it, depending how important the clothes were to you.
But if you're at the point of thinking I have to burn my clothes, well,
why
a normal
would
person would just
it?
Throw them out.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's just deer blood.
Yeah, if you put it in a paper bag, a plastic bag, and throw it out. No big deal.
I've never seen an explanation for if it was just a normal, they were covered in blood from hunting, why would the automatic response be to burn it? I've never seen an explanation for that.
I don't know.
Obviously, that would be a very weird response unless you're trying to hide something.
I think it's interesting how we all started out, the four of us, with, I would say, some preconceived ideas. And I will just be completely honest and tell you that, yes, my background is as a prosecutor. And I thought, Cal Harris, it's always the guy. You know, it's always the man. It's always the husband that kills the wife. And there was a lot of evidence, I thought, against him. In fact, two juries had convicted him. So I was completely against Cal. I would say that Jen was in the other category of it's not Cal, it's the Gone Girl theory. Willie, where were you when we started with this?
I was a little bit on the fence, but I was definitely on the Cal did it side.
Cal did it side,
of
right.
Of that fence.
Rick, where were you?
I was probably more inclined to believe he was guilty without knowing the full story. But then as it progressed, as we evolved into the background, and especially with Barquette, mm-hmm. you know, that totally changed my way of thinking.
Now, he is a defense lawyer. He's supposed to do that.
Yeah, sure. And I always kept that in mind. But he didn't seem like your normal kind of let me deflect on that point.
Right.
He took everything head on.
He did. He answered every question.
Right. And I think I mentioned to you, Lise, that the juror that we interviewed,
Angela,
I thought when I actually listened back while I was helping to put the podcast together, you know, I was listening very closely to what she was saying, and she seemed like the type of person when she was talking about how old she was, she had a young baby at home, she mentioned that no one wanted to be there in the jury room. It seemed like they wanted to just get something done and get it done quickly. And that was the first trial, correct?
Right, that was the first trial.
Yeah, so it just didn't seem like the type of deliberation I would expect because it was fairly quick.
It was just a few hours. Yeah, it was very quick.
So I don't know what kind of defense he had for that trial. It doesn't sound like it was adequate at all.
Yeah, not Mr. Barquette. Also, I thought Michael Bodden, when he came in here, remember Dr. Bodden, the forensics expert? He kind of started changing my mind, too, because he talked about the blood spatters. We haven't talked that much about it in this podcast, but the blood spatters were the physical evidence, and there really wasn't much of it. And Dr. Bodden really kind of, I wouldn't say completely discounted it, the blood spatter, but he really gave me pause, like, it could have been any time. She could have cut her arm. You know, she could have, anything could have left those spatters there. We can't really tell when they were, how old they were, after even a few hours. At that point, you can't tell whether they've been there for a day or 3 weeks. So many interesting characters in this.
At the end of it, I started to turn around through the interviews.
Right.
Okay, at the
me
end
too.
Of it, I'm on the side that Cal actually may be innocent.
Right.
And I've had the benefit of being able to watch a lot of video online and reading a lot of articles about the story. And just the way Cal carried himself throughout this as well just made me believe that he's carrying himself as someone who is innocent, who is fighting for his innocence.
And fighting for his daughters.
And fighting for his kids.
Mm-hmm. Right. He testified. Who does that? If you're a defendant, you know, most often a defense lawyer is going to say, absolutely
don't
not.
Don't take the stand. Right.
Right. And he, for whatever reason, he decided to testify.
Well, for his innocence in his mind.
For his innocence, right, right.
I think I definitely started this thinking, as a lawyer, there's not enough evidence to go beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty. After we dug through it for close to 2 months, and we spoke with Bruce Barquette, I really started to feel like on a non-lawyer level, I don't think he did it.
Lawyers can be humans, too.
Right. Yeah, and I think that there's just so much against Stacey Stewart and Chris Thomason that they should really, you know, they left New York. They just left their jobs, their houses, months after she disappears. And in this third trial, Bruce Barquette was able to allow Kevin Tubbs to say that the man he saw Michelle with on the 12th was
Stacey
Stewart.
And remember, Kevin Tubbs is the farmer who drove by the residence and was really the reason that the first trial was overturned, because he says, What did he say?
He said he saw her on the 12th, which means the whole theory that Cal killed her on the night of the 11th is just blown.
Right, and that's why there was a second trial.
And he saw her with a man, not Cal Harris, who was angry, and she looked like she was upset.
And that could have been Chris or Stacy.
Right. Well, he identified it as Stacy in the third trial.
Oh, right. Okay, that's right.
And then I think we first learned from Barquette that there was someone else who apparently corroborated Kevin Tubbs' story. This is not in the trials because this person died, so now it's just hearsay. But Kevin Tubbs coming forward after a guilty verdict before sentencing is sort of
weird.
Like too coincidental.
Right.
But if there's another person who says they saw the same thing,
That corroborates. Right. So predictions. We're going to hear, and we'll stay with this, listeners. We're going to stay with it in August when we will find out whether there will be a fourth trial. I'll throw out our predictions. I predict there will be a fourth trial based on this prosecutor wanting it.
For the people of the county up there, I hope that there isn't a fourth trial. I mean, it's expensive. I've always felt, at what point is enough enough? I mean, I do believe there will be a fourth trial.
Okay. Jen?
Fourth trial, for sure.
Rick?
I think there will be a fourth trial, but I'm just wondering why the prosecutor hasn't been chastened by that dissenting justice who was pretty brutal in his dissent.
the second trial. Yeah, and
basically,
then this is
right. Basically saying, like, look, there's no evidence here. So
right.
If it gets back up to me, you know, you're
going down.
Right.
And chastened by the fact that now the prosecutor must know, as we discovered, that it was 6-6 in this third trial.
Right.
So it's
right.
really uphill. And if any of that evidence comes in that Barquette wanted in about Stacey and Chris, that's going to make it harder.
Lise, can you speak to this as a former prosecutor and having an ego as a prosecutor? And I don't mean you specifically, just when when this is your whole ball of wax, everything you have is riding on this one suspect, and there's a lot of doubt thrown up, especially in the last trial. Where does ego play into are we going to have another trial? Because that's what it seems to be all about now.
That's a great question. And I would say ego plays a huge part. Now, no prosecutor is going to admit to that. But when you go in the courtroom as a prosecutor, you want to win. And you want to keep that winning record 100%. And to have a loss, especially a Cal Harris loss, which is a big case in them part of the woods, this is a big deal. You don't want to let that go. Once you focused on that guy as being your suspect, the guy, it's really hard to let that go.
Right, because you don't want to be the one to introduce doubt by introducing another suspect.
Right.
Right.
Even though you're supposed to do that as a prosecutor. Prosecutor, you're supposed to be about justice, not about getting one guy. But that changes along the way. And don't forget, this crime happened in 2001, September 11th. This happened a long time ago. They've been through a bunch of prosecutors. Now this guy's finally got it. He's going to get the case. He's going to make the case against Cal. Dang it. Guys, it's hard for us to let go of this trial. So we're not going to let go. We'll still be with it in August and report back. In the meanwhile, we are searching for new materials, new cases that we can go out and investigate and do field trips like we did before. This isn't TV land that we just have to give you a 5-minute soundbite or something like that. As you can tell, I hope, from listening to these podcasts, we really do a lot of research. We really get into this case, and my view of it has changed tremendously. We're searching for new cases, new trials to cover, something in your area that you think hasn't gotten enough media attention that would give us something that we can really look at and investigate. That's what we're here for, this little team of compatriots, the four of us, and we'll go out and investigate on Wheel of Justice. And I hope that you'll write to us at Wheel of Justice, and remember, that's Wheel, spelled W-I-E-H-L, of Justice, hashtag Wheel of Justice, and find us at foxnewsradio.com. Boy, this has been so much fun, and I can't wait to go on to the next case with you guys. Till next time.